Hi guys, we're going to get started. My name is Sam Erickson. I'm the president of AHA, which is short for Atheists, Humanists, and Agnostics. This is Free Thought Fest. Tonight we have the privilege of welcoming two debaters, Matt Slick from Karm.org. He's the co-founder, or just the founder, of Karm.org, which is the Christian apologetics research ministry, and Dan Barker, who is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Tonight we'll be answering the question, or attempting to answer the question, does God exist? And with that, I'll hand it over to our moderator, Chris Babe.
Does God exist? This question has been asked by countless intellectuals over the last thousands of years. It's one of the most important philosophical questions our species has ever faced, and it has troubled mankind since time immemorial. Yet humanity has been unable to come to a consensus on the issue, so we debate the question, does God exist? First, we will have a 20-minute opening statement from Matt, followed by a 20-minute opening statement from Dan. Matt, you can begin.
How are y'all doing this evening? Oh, not bad, good. All right, well, I want to thank you for having me here. Really appreciate it. It's been quite a struggle to get here. Canceled flights, delayed flights, but I'm here, so praise God. All right. Now, tonight's topic, does God exist? All right. Well, I believe he does. But let me make it clear that I'm not arguing for the generic existence of any kind of a God concept, but only the God of the Bible. I am an ordained minister. I'm a Trinitarian who believes in salvation that can be found only through the person and work of Jesus, who, according to the scriptures, is God in flesh, who died on the cross for our sins and rose from the dead 3 days later. Since I believe this, and I take the affirmative position in our debate, then the burden is upon me to at least try and demonstrate that God exists. But in order to do this, I'm not going to do it the wrong way. I won't put on a lab coat. I won't produce a microscope, get an x-ray machine in order to try and detect God's existence through some experimentation, some procedures. This is the wrong approach because scientific methodology is designed to detect, repeat, and explain phenomena in the material world, not the world outside of it. It is not designed to detect existence or the existence of a divine person who transcends it. Now think about it. Do you know of any person who behaves in a mechanistic, naturalistic, predictable fashion? Because God is a person. Or are there aspects of irregularity, unpredictability, and variableness in their behavior due to them being persons that don't fit in the scientific method? Let me just tell you, going to the scientific method to try and find God is the wrong approach. In my article on my website, karm.org, what kind of evidence should we expect from a transcendent God? I say, quote, since a transcendent God who created the universe would not be limited to it, but would transcend it, then we can expect that evidence for God's existence would share transcendent characteristics. Close quote. Therefore, if we encounter transcendent characteristics in the world, then we have encountered evidence for God's existence. I'll propose just such evidence in a bit, but before I do that, I need to make a comment. Generally, we find what we're looking for, and our presuppositions determine what we look for, how we look, and how we interpret what we find. Our presuppositions can blind us, or they can help us see. Therefore, when assessing God's existence, a person's presuppositions need to be examined for consistency, rationality, and accuracy. But that is a topic for another time, and I'd love to discuss that. Presuppositions form a worldview, and in our debate tonight, we have two worldviews to work from. We have the one that contains God and the worldview that does not contain God. We could say that there is a worldview that contains transcendence and one that does not. If you're an atheist, then your worldview necessarily excludes God, as well as any transcendent qualities he might possess, such as his independence of the universe and his being beyond space and time. As an atheist, you must exclude the transcendent characteristics because they are, by definition, independent of the natural realm. But if we can discover transcendent characteristics in the universe, then it would seem we've discovered evidence for God's existence. Then interpreting that evidence would depend on your presuppositions. Now, I believe, again, I want to say this, I believe we have encountered transcendent characteristics in our world, and that the Christian worldview, not the atheistic perspective, best accounts for them. Okay, so let me introduce to you a pair of opposites, God and not God. There is no third option in this set, because there's either the thing or the negation of the thing. Excuse me. We have the thing and the negation of the thing, God or not God. Furthermore, if there are multiple gods, then there's at least a God. In this antonymic pair, antonyms are opposites, we only have two options that can have explanatory power. For example, we can say that God created the universe or God did not create the universe. Both cannot be true, but at least one of them must be. Now we can apply this principle here in the debate. God either exists or God does not exist, and if we can demonstrate that the no-God position is incapable of explaining transcendent characteristics that relate to human experience, then the only other option must be validated, namely that God exists. Furthermore, just to clarify, to have a lack of belief in God falls in the category of the no-God position, since it is identical with it in explanatory power. Now, Mr. Barker, I like Dan. I almost consider my friend. We've talked lately and been on my radio show a few weeks ago. He's a nice guy, so here we go. You said in your debate with Doug Wilson in 1997 on the topic, does the triune God exist, that, quote, logic is not some capital L thing existing up in the universe we need to find. It is just a function of the mind, a function of the human brain, close quote. Well, I agree that logic is a function of the brain, but not just the brain. We both know that people can reason correctly. But how would you recognize correct reasoning if not by appealing to something outside the brain, such as the laws of logic, which guide proper reasoning? But these laws cannot be the product of the human brain. Otherwise, there is no way to determine if a person's reasoning is right or wrong. When the brain functions logically, it must be in harmony with the laws of logic. When the brain functions illogically, then it is not in harmony with those laws. But those laws are external to and independent of the brain, since they govern it in regard to proper reasoning. Furthermore, the laws of logic are special kinds of propositions, since they are about truth. And that's one reason we know they require a mind, because no material thing can be about another thing. Truth statements require minds. I'm fighting a bad head cold. What's that?
How about a laying on of
hands? A what? I couldn't hear you.
Laying on of hands for prayer. Should I try it?
Maybe try the mockery later. I speak in public all the time. It's not nerves. I'm actually having trouble with a head cold. My apologies. All right. So the first four laws of classical logic are, one, the law of identity, which states that something is what it is and is not what it is not. The law of non-contradiction, which says that a statement cannot be both true and false in the same time at the same sense. The law of excluded middle, which says that a statement is either true or false. I'm having trouble. And the law of proper inference, which states if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. I don't know if you're familiar with these laws. You cannot have rational discourse without them. There are other laws, but these four laws must be held to, or you cannot have rational discourse. How does the atheistic perspective account for these laws? If the laws of logic are just functions of the human brain, as Mr. Barker has stated, then that explanation cannot work because brains are different and people contradict each other. Furthermore, if someone's physical brain causes him to deny the law of non-contradiction, that law is not invalidated. It's still true. Therefore, this proves that the logical thinking occurs in the brain and that laws of logic do not depend upon human brains for their validity. If these logical laws are agreed upon principles that people recognize as true, then they are recognizing principles that already exist. But how is it possible to have pre-existent logical propositions in an atheistic worldview? And if it is people who declare these axioms to be true, then do the logical propositions become untrue when people decide they don't serve their subjective wants anymore? If these laws of logic are descriptions of natural phenomena, then how do you, for example, observe the law of proper inference in nature, which says if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, without first presupposing the validity of the laws of logic which you use to deduce its truth? To do so is to beg the question. If these laws of logic are said to be properties of the universe, then they should be measurable, since properties of the physical realm are quantifiable, whether they be things such as hardness, mass, polarity, or density. But you cannot apply this to the laws of logic. Furthermore, these laws of logic are characteristics that contain universality. They're true for everyone, all the time. If you don't agree with the law of logic, the law of non-contradiction, it doesn't make it go away. We know that when people contradict themselves, we know they're just wrong. But these laws are there. They're not just a function of the brain. And they have a universality to them. They have a quality that applies to everyone all the time. They transcend space and time. They have a transcendent characteristic. Now, which worldview best provides the rational justification for these transcendent universal truths? Is it the Christian worldview that proposes a transcendent mind that is the Christian God and who has revealed these universally true laws, which are reflections of his perfect transcendent mind? Or are they the product of human brain action via evolution that assigns universal truth principles in the physical world and asserts them as a function of the physical brain? I assert that it's the former, which makes sense, and the atheistic perspective does not and cannot. Now, let's move on to the next issue. I agree that the consensus of the scientists, the universe had a beginning. So there's no need to argue this. If the universe had a beginning, then it brought itself into existence, or it did not bring itself into existence. Since nothing comes from nothing, unless you're into magic and children's imaginations, then we can conclude that the universe did not cause itself to exist. Instead, it was caused to exist by something other than itself. There are only two options to account for this cause, personal and non-personal. There's no third option. So let's look at the impersonal cause, the atheistic cause. An impersonal cause of the universe had to exist prior to the universe. Since time appears to be a function of the physical realm, the prior cause must have existed in a timeless state. This cause must also have had the necessary and sufficient conditions to bring the universe into existence. But if it was an impersonal cause that possessed the necessary and sufficient conditions, then the resultant creation would have been automatic. Let me illustrate. If I want to move a boulder with a lever, I would need both the necessary and sufficient conditions. The necessary conditions would be the boulder, the ground, a fulcrum, a lever, and a counterweight. But if one of those necessary conditions is not sufficient, say the counterweight is not heavy enough, then the boulder will not move. But as soon as all the necessary conditions are also sufficient, which includes the counterweight being heavy enough, the result in this impersonal arrangement is automatic. The boulder moves. But if we add a personable variable, say a person's ability to pull the lever when she decides to, then the result occurs when she decides it will occur. Now, if there were an impersonal cause that also possessed the necessary and sufficient conditions to create the universe, then the creation would necessarily have been automatic. Since the impersonal cause existed, for lack of a better term, forever, then the universe would have been brought into existence automatically an infinitely long time ago. But this is not the case. Since the universe is not infinitely old, then it is not possible that an impersonal cause brought the universe into existence an infinitely long time ago. something that would create the universe had to exist in a timeless state before it and unchanging, but it had to have the necessary and sufficient conditions. It automatically would have occurred infinitely long time ago, which means the universe would be infinitely old, but it's not, so therefore that can't work. It makes more sense to say that there was a personal cause that contained both the necessary and sufficient conditions, and that in a particular moment of his choosing, decided to say, let there be light, and the universe came into existence. In the case of the creation of the universe, this would mean that the personal being transcends the universe itself and is the cause of it and decided to create it at a particular point in the time past. Hence, another example of transcendence. Now, Mr. Barker, you said in your book, Godless, page 101, if something is true, we don't invoke faith. Instead, we use reason to prove it. Faith is intellectual bankruptcy. Mr. Barker, as an atheist, without invoking faith, that science will come up with an answer. Without simply dismissing the question, can you provide an explanation for the cause of the universe that is based on reason? Let me get to my final segment here. In your debate with Peter Payne at the University of Wisconsin, I'm assuming that's here, in March of 2005, you said, quote, there are no actions in and of themselves that are always absolutely right or wrong. It depends on the context, close quote. But what you said is self-refuting. You propose an absolute moral law about actions, namely, that the moral right or wrong of any action always depends on context. So you provided an absolute moral truth about actions, but how is that possible in an atheistic viewpoint, in an atheistic worldview? How can anybody have an absolute moral? You cannot. Nevertheless, your sentiment makes sense from an atheistic perspective, but it means that no one, no atheist, can rationally justify any objection about the behavior of God in the Bible, nor could you rationally condemn any actions of the Nazis killing the Jews, or anybody or anything. What gives you the right to judge the actions of any God in any particular context? In your atheism, you cannot have an objective, non-changing standard by which you can make consistent, absolute moral judgments. But I have heard countless atheists tell me, that's wrong. And they don't have any basis for it other than their opinions. There is no moral objective standard. And I question them on it. Conversations don't last very long. If you say, though, that societies have evolved and we have learned what better behavior is, which is begging the question, and has its own philosophical problems, then that means the majority, whatever the majority wants is right. It would then mean that you cannot condemn the Nazis. It would mean you cannot condemn anybody. But more significantly, by appealing to the principle that society determines what is right and wrong, you're saying that there is a universal moral principle, a moral ought, that states that what people want is morally right and ought to be followed. But that's self-contradictory. It doesn't work in an atheist perspective. In that same debate, you said, quote, there is no universal ought, close quote. This must also mean that you cannot assign a universal moral value to the principle, quote, that which enhances humanity is good, that which threatens it is evil, close quote, which is what you said in your book, Losing Faith in Faith, on page 134. In addition, you said in your debate with Doug Wilson in 1997 that morality is an issue of avoiding pain.
2 minutes.
Well, besides assigning an absolute moral value there, how do you know that your statement is true? And did you use a scientific method to determine that? Now, I've quoted you in order to demonstrate your inconsistency and the inconsistency of the atheistic perspective. Is it possible for atheists to offer any rational, necessary preconditions analysis for the transcendentals that exist in the universe, in the nature of logical absolutes, in the necessary conditions that must exist in order for the universe to not be infinitely old, but have been created at a finite point in time by decision, and moral absolutes, which I know atheists love to cite in their righteousness, yet have no basis intellectually to ever assert that something is right or is wrong. You can only have your opinion. In three very important areas, logic, laws of logic, our existence, and objective morality, the Christian worldview makes sense because we can say it is a revelation from the very character and the mind of God. It may not like the explanation, but it works. Especially when we note that there are transcendental aspects evident in each category that cannot, in my opinion, be explained from the no-God perspective, but can be explained when we include God in our presuppositional set. So when we only have two worldviews to work from, God and not God, and the no-God position is found to lack the necessary explanatory power for transcendent characteristics, then the position that God exists is validated. God exists.
Thank you, Matt. Dan, you have 20 minutes. Dan, you have 20 minutes for an opening statement.
Thank you, Matt.
My mic on?
Know how you feel. I think in our last debate, I was the one who was sick, right? And you were like worried about me, so.
Yes, I was.
I used to have the gift of healing. I'm sorry I don't have that anymore. I can't. I'm sorry you're feeling bad, but I'm glad you made it. What a valiant effort, battling the weather and Delta Airlines.
And canceled flights and late ones and missed planes.
So as you know, I used to believe like Matt. I was an ordained minister. I preached for 19 years. I preached pretty much what he believes, although Protestants have their little different wrinkles in their theologies. And these days, we're not killing ourselves over them like they used to in the past, fortunately. Like John Calvin murdering his friend and co-reformer, Michael Servetus, over a simple little theological difference about whether the Trinity is real. In fact, Servetus was right. John Calvin was wrong about the Trinity in the Bible. And what did John Calvin do? He could have stopped the execution, but he didn't. Today, there's no burning fires for us to talk about. Today, we're much more civil. And I like Matt as a person. He knows how to conduct an intelligent dialogue. I believe strongly that Jesus was my Savior. I confess my sins. I believe that the Bible was inerrant and true. I traveled and I preached to Mexico. I preached all over the United States. I was in Mexico trying to convert Catholics into Christians, you know, that kind of a missionary. And it worked. And but I changed my mind, and I can't tell you that whole story tonight, but you can read about it in the book that Matt read, the book Godless, or in my book Losing Faith in Faith, where I tell how I went through a process. And most of that process, for me, hinged on the Bible. I used to believe the Bible was the inerrant, rock-solid basis for truth, that we needed an operating manual for our species. But I painfully learned that the Bible is not a reliable source of truth. I used to preach it. I used to believe it. I sometimes saw what I thought were answers to prayer. In fact, one of my buddies had lost his voice, and I laid my hands on Gary and said, "Be healed in Jesus' name," and his voice came back. Shall we try it tonight? Maybe. Most of the times, those things didn't happen. It's kind of like confirmation bias. I saw what I wanted to see. You find what you're looking for. And now I know that there are perfectly good natural explanations for what I thought were answers to prayer. But the Bible was the big deal. I remember meeting some Christians who had a different point of view from me, who thought that Adam and Eve were not historical. And I thought, that's horrible. That's heresy. God mentions Adam and Eve as historical people. But those Christians, good Christians, they went to church. They thought Adam and Eve were just sort of a metaphor, kind of like how Jesus made up stories. Jesus made up the story of the prodigal son. It doesn't matter if it's a true story. You wouldn't call him a liar, would you? He just made up a story to teach a lesson, right? There was no real prodigal son. There's not even a name for him. And so the early Israelites did a similar thing with Adam and Eve. We now know from evolution, the fact of evolution, there could not have been an Adam and Eve. And even if there were, they would have come out of Africa. We know that our species came out of Africa, not the Middle East. So these Christians thought, well, then the Adam and Eve story in the Garden of Eden is also sort of a metaphorical, not an actually true thing. And then I got to thinking, well, then, okay, the prodigal son is a parable and Adam and Eve are a metaphor. Then what other characters in that book? Maybe God himself is just one huge figure of speech. And basically, that's what it is. It's one big metaphor that one particular religion invented. The Bible is full of contradictions. It's full of unhistorical comments. It's full of anachronisms. You read recently last month out of Tel Aviv how the Bible got it wrong about the domesticated camels during the time of the patriarchs. That's just a factual archaeological error. There are scientific mistakes, and so There is some truth in the Bible, but basically my confidence in the reliability of revealed scripture fell dramatically. And then my whole idea about the existence of God. So we're debating the existence of something. And if you notice, and during my rebuttal, I'll reply to Matt's comments. We're debating the existence of something that Matt hasn't even defined yet. He just uses this word God, and he says God of the Bible. But he actually hasn't defined this being. So I suppose I need to ask you, how are you defining it? What is he made of? The Bible says God is a spirit. So I'm going to have to ask you, what in the heck does the word spirit mean? Define it for us. And if spirit is something as opposed to nothing, then it must be measurable in some way. But in any debate like we're having tonight, the burden of proof is on the affirmative. Matt and I both agree there's a natural world. You know, we agree with that. We agree that that our bodies are physical, biological organisms. We agree with that. But Matt's making an additional assertion above and beyond what we both agree. And so when that happens, the burden of proof is on the shoulders of the person who makes that claim. If I were to claim, Matt, I've invented a perpetual motion machine. And Matt were to say, really, I want to see it. No, I just want you to believe it. No, but you need to show it to me. Can I just fold my arms and say, well, prove that I have it? You can't do that. The burden of proof is on the shoulders of the person making the claim. Atheism is simply the absence of a belief in that claim. There is a tiny subset of atheists that you might call anti-theists, but in general, atheism is just the absence of a belief. So I'm an atheist because of a certain number of absences. I have my own addictions here, caffeine. The goddess Caffeina, I think is what his name, her name. A number of absences which justify not believing in a God. You can't prove there's no leprechauns, can you? In fact, there's evidence for leprechauns. Have you ever eaten a box of Lucky Charms, right? So there's evidence for leprechauns, right? But you can't prove there's not. They might be hiding. So what most of us are in this room are a-leprechaunists. I guess we could say there are two competing worldviews in this world. There is the leprechaunist worldview and the a-leprechaunist worldview, like Matt was trying to say. But with the existence of a God, I notice a number of lacks or absences. The first one, of course, is the absence of a definition, which Matt hasn't given us yet, except in some nebulous terms of some transcendent person, right? Whatever that means. But he needs to be a little more clear about what he's arguing for. There's never been a coherent definition of this God offered that makes any sense. In fact, many of the definitions, including the Christian definition of God, contains mutually incompatible properties. Here's just one example. I call it FANG, the free will argument for the non-existence of God. This is just one. If you, it depends, and there's a constellation of characteristics that different theologians have put together to try to make their God work or not. Is he omniscient? Is he omnipotent? Is he all of these things? And they tinker with definitions. And I know the Calvinist one is a little more extreme, but FANG, think about this. Whatever you think about free will, maybe humans have it, maybe we don't. But whatever you think about free will, certainly theists think that God has it, right? God is able to make decisions. But if you know the future, you can't have free will. If you know your own future decisions, they are fixed and they are unchangeable. If the future is fixed and unchangeable in your own mind, you don't have the ability or any period of indeterminacy for you to say, oh, wait, I'm going to change my mind. If you did change your mind, then you were not omniscient in the first place. Something's got to give. There's a whole bunch of incompatible properties that define certain types of gods, like the Christian God, that if that's the God you're arguing for, then that God not only does not exist, but that God cannot exist. It'd be like having a debate over the existence of married bachelors. Well, that's not a debate. Such a thing cannot exist. And many of the ways the Christian God is defined simply cannot logically exist. The second absence, of course, is the absence of evidence. And Matt has proposed some evidence tonight, which are actually non-evidences, and I'll talk about them in my rebuttal. If there were actually evidence for a God, real evidence, in the sense that we would call, and just calling it scientific isn't ruling out transcendence, by the way. Because transcendence is not the same as supernatural. There might be a transcendent world that's not supernatural or that's not a God. Scientists haven't closed their minds to the transcendent. In fact, if there's a multiverse, the multiverse is transcendent. of the universe that we live within. It's part of the natural world, of course. But if there were evidence for a God, it would be on the table. Matt would have put it right there. In fact, by now, somebody would have won the Nobel Prize for pointing out the existence of a hitherto unknown force in the cosmos. That, look at this. Any scientist in the world, we have some science students here. Wouldn't that be something? I mean, are you sticking your head in the sand? Nope, there's no God. No, I don't want to. If you could find it, if you could show, for example, that prayer actually worked better, if you could actually have evidence that the Bible means what it says when it says, all things whatsoever you shall ask for in my name, believing you shall receive. Or is any sick among you, let them call the elders and anoint the head with oil and bring them, and the prayer of faith will heal the sick. If there were any kind of that evidence that the Bible actually is telling the truth, then that would be on the table and somebody's going to win the Nobel Prize for that. I mean, that would be incredible. If I were a scientist, I'd love to prove that. There's none. There's nothing. There's zero. You notice when you debate, they bring up little things like fulfilled prophecy, maybe, or some miracle from some anecdote. But when you scratch beneath the surface, you see that it's usually random chance or confirmation bias. And what it comes down to is faith. The Bible is real big on faith, and the book that Matt is arguing for is the book that's pro-faith. But suppose, for example, the Higgs boson was a hypothesis, just like neutrinos were a hypothesis that were later confirmed by observation. Suppose before the Higgs boson had been discovered, scientists were getting together every Sunday morning in a circle like this. Yes, the Higgs boson is real. I know the Higgs boson is real. I will have faith. I will not waver. I will resist the secular world. I know the Higgs boson is real. The God particle is real. Amen. You know, if they did that every Sunday, getting together to bolster up their faith, you would think they were pretty insecure on the concept. But that's exactly what happens in the churches that Matt goes to. That's what happens in Sunday mornings. They're getting together to bolster their faith, to believe in spite of the lack of evidence. There is no good evidence for a God. Or if you think there is, it's the kind of evidence that Lucky Charms is for leprechauns. I mean, it's stories, it's myth-making, and we can explain all those in natural terms. Another lack is the lack of a good argument for a God. And there are about a dozen arguments that apologists and theologians have brought forth, and Matt raised two of them tonight, a presuppositionalist argument and a cosmological argument. And to some degree, a moral argument. But if you scratch beneath the surface and unpack these arguments, most of them end up begging the question. Most of them end up turning back around on themselves. For example, Matt didn't put design on the table tonight, he put cosmology. But Richard Dawkins points out, and many others have pointed out, that any person or thing that's capable of designing something that's complex. Say you're a watchmaker. Say you're designing stuff. Anything that can design something like a watch has to be at least as complex as the thing that it's designing. So if functional complexity requires a designer, then the mind of the designer requires a designer. If the mind of the designer doesn't, then jettison your argument. You don't need it. You've already begged the question. You've already assumed the existence of this thing that you're trying to then kind of back argue through some kind of cosmological design arguments. Most of them end up coming back around and begging the question. In philosophy, the term begging the question just is another way of saying circular logic. It's when you bring your conclusion into the premise. And in arguments like cosmology and design, the premise is saying things like, everything except God needs to be designed, therefore there's a God. Well, you can see the illogic in that. Ontological arguments have fallen flat. Bertrand Russell said that when he was a teenager, he was briefly convinced of the existence of God by the ontological argument. And then he woke up the next morning and he said, it's all just bad grammar. When you think about the words, you're trying to prove God with just words rather than observation, like Matt's trying to do tonight. No observation, no evidence, nothing testable, just words. When you try to do that, it turns into like a mind game. And during my rebuttal, I'll show you the mind game that Matt is playing when it comes to these logical presuppositionless things. Another lack is the lack of an agreement among God believers. If there really is a God, there really is this being who created us and cares about us and loves us, don't you think he'd be careful enough to make himself known to us in a very clear way? In the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, you know that verse where Paul tells Christians, Matt, let there be no divisions among you. You should be of one mind. And then later in Corinthians, he says, for God is not the author of confusion. Can you think of a single book that's caused more confusion than the Bible? They fight with each other. They disagree with each other. Strangely, Paul didn't tell us which person you should follow so that there should be no division. I suppose he was talking about John Calvin. Who knows? But Christians fight with each other. They don't agree with each other about the nature of a God. They've had splits and schisms. Even in the very early church, there were at least 8 or 10 different types of nature of Jesus divisions and fights amongst each other, which were very fierce. People were getting killed over that. And of course, Protestants and Catholics. The 30 Years' War is one example, which started for a lot of reasons, but primarily because of the confessional differences like infant baptism and transubstantiation and stuff, these doctrines that they think were so important. Christians can't get their act together. They don't even know what this God is they're arguing for, and especially when it comes to moral principles. Matt talks about moral absolutes, but you can't name a single issue in society that we are struggling with. You can't name one issue on which good, church-going, loving Christian families who read the Bible and pray are not marching on both sides. Think about it. Women's rights, birth control, abortion rights, gay marriage, gun control. What are some other issues that we're fighting with? The war, climate change, doctor-assisted suicide. You name it. All of these social issues that are supposedly have moral absolutes from his book, there is no moral absolute. Good people are on both sides. Good church-going, Bible-believing people are disagreeing with each other on these issues that are supposedly being guided by their God. There's no agreement. The lack of agreement among believers is a serious problem for the belief in a God, and not just within Christianity, but over the entire world. Matt, you guys get your act together first, and then come back to us and tell us about this clear-headed, all-loving, moral being that you are pretending to worship. Another lack, of course, is a good reply to the problem of evil. And theologians admit that's the Achilles heel in theology, the problem of evil. If, and this has to do with the characteristics of the deity, if God is a good God, and in most Christian theology, God is benevolent, God is a good God, he wants what is good. If God is a good God, then the problem of evil is a serious problem towards the existence of that God. Of course, God might be a bad God. He might be an evil God, which might explain a lot. There might be a God, but he just doesn't give a you-know-what about us. He's going to say, I want you to pray to me, but I'm going to ignore you. I would ask you, Matt, don't answer it now, but if you had known on 9/11 what was in the mind of those hijackers, if you had seen those Christian families in the Twin Towers with families that they loved and kids that they cared about, singing God Bless America on the National Day of Prayer, asking for God's blessing for our country to protect us. If you had known what was in the mind of those hijackers, and at no risk to yourself, if you could have stopped them from crashing those planes, would you have done it? Yeah, I would too. So you're nicer than God. God knew about it, God could have done it, but he did nothing. And in my mind, he's an accomplice. If such a God does exist, he's an evil God.
2 minutes.
He's an accomplice to the crime. 2 minutes, perfect. So the problem of evil, I say this a lot, but it's still true. All you have to do is walk into any children's hospital, and you know there's no God. Those families are praying for their kids. They love them just as much. It's a tragedy what's happening. But those kids, no matter who they are, die at the same random rate. God is silent. Prayers are not answers. There's no evidence for a God. And the problem of evil at least eliminates the possibility of a good God. And then finally, there's no need for a God. Millions of good people. In this country, tens of millions of good people live happy, productive, meaningful, moral, loving lives without believing in some transcendent spook or ghost or being up there to give us our meaning and our joy and our purpose. We find it within the natural world. We feel, most of us atheists and agnostics, and I don't speak for all, atheism is not like a creed. In fact, atheists welcome disagreement, and we're not going to fight to the death over these things. But I think most atheists and agnostics agree that meaning doesn't have to be ultimate and absolute to be meaningful. Just because something doesn't last forever doesn't mean it has no value. Suppose you were planning a vacation in the next couple weeks. You're looking forward to it. What are you going to do? You're going to go skiing or hiking or visiting friends or you're going to, whatever, you're going to enjoy your vacation. But then you realize, oh, wait a minute. When my vacation is over, I'm going to have to go back to work. I may as well not go. Is that what you would say? You would go on the vacation. It doesn't have to be eternal. It doesn't have to be ultimate. It doesn't have to be absolute to have value. And that's how we atheists and agnostics realize you don't need the eternal, the ultimate, the absolute. We can find meaning and joy here within the local context of the world in which we do live. For all of these reasons and many more, which I'll talk about during rebuttal, the lack of belief in a God is a rationally justifiable position.
Thank you, Dan. Matt, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Dan. The debate is not about the Bible. The debate is not about its reliability, nor John Calvin, or Cyrenius, or the doctrine of the Trinity, or hypostatic union, or the Trinity. If you want a significant Bible study today after, I'll teach you about those things and give you the facts. But the debate is not about that. The debate is about the existence of God. I have tried to present to you rational reasons for the existence of God. Now, you may not think that those reasons are rational. You may think that I'm going to be
But nevertheless, I hope you heard me. Believing in God is rational because the alternative is irrational. You cannot have any problem of evil if you're an atheist, right? Think about it. What's evil? He wants me to define what God is. God is that omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent God who has full of omnisapience, all wisdom, who has the quality of aseity, the independence and immutability of his nature and his essence. We describe something by the attributes that present. That's perfectly valid. He asked me to define that, but yet he uses free will and doesn't define what free will is. And he says, and I got the quote if you want it, we have the illusion of free will. As an atheist, you can't even have free will. Your worldview cannot make sense. This is the problem. It cannot make sense. Think about it. If evolution is true and the physical laws of the universe are all they are, then your brain is restricted to those physical laws and you are not able to prove you have free will thought. You can't prove that your rationalizations are correct because it's just a function of your brain. And it might be that your wiring says yes and his says no. Which is right or wrong? You have to appeal to something outside of you to do that. Which is why I brought up the issue of the transcendentals that demonstrate the rationality of the position. Now, he didn't address the issue of the transcendentals, and I'm waiting for him. I've talked to a lot of atheists about the transcendentals, and I'll tell you something. This is a little bit subjective, but I have never found any convincing answer from an atheist perspective to give me any rational account for what's called the necessary preconditions for intelligibility. Atheists inevitably commit logical fallacies in the process, and they must because their atheism hamstrings their ability to think rationally. Sometimes on my radio show, and I'm not feeling too well, I say, excuse me, I'm really tired. I got one frontal lobe tied behind my back. Okay, atheist, give me a call. Now, I try to be entertaining on the radio, and I want atheists to call me up, but I love talking to atheists because I'll tell you something. Atheism is not logical. It's irrational. If your brain is the function of the physical laws, tell me how you have free will. Tell me how you are able to justify it intellectually, that you are free outside of the parameters of the physical laws that govern what happens up here. And you want to tell me that you can think rationally? Justify the reason why you can in the first place. Justify to me the problem of theodicy, the problem of evil. There's no problem of evil in Christianity. God uses it, just as he used the death of my son who died in my arms and I literally heard his last heartbeat. Literally heard his last heartbeat. I wept that day hard. Did I say God doesn't exist because my child died? He don't exist. My child is changing. Come on, think. Use your heads and don't put your emotions in front of the issues and use emotional arguments. No disrespect meant, Dan, but you're using emotional arguments. You're not sticking to the topic. Does God exist? It's not about the Bible. It's not about emotional arguments. It's not about children in hospitals. And if a child is healed, it's not God who did it. Oh, it's some spontaneous thing of evolution or whatever. But if he doesn't get healed, well, then it's not God. God doesn't exist because there's no evidence. Presuppositions govern how you interpret actuality. That's the fact. That's the fact. Now, I love it when atheists try and give me logical arguments against God's existence. I have a whole list of them on my website, carm.org. 2 million page views every month, carm.org. Go look it up, go to the atheism section, see their great arguments, and see me just simply answer them. Bang, 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 bang. Give me another one. You got one? Give it to me. I would love it. If you can prove God does not exist, or the irrationality of God's existence, really? It's not possible to prove the negative, though, is it? Well, actually, it is technically. We'll get into that. Now, if God has free will and you can't know he knows what you're going to do, you don't have a choice to be able to do it, you don't have free will, you know what I could say is your chemical reactions in your brain programmed you to say that. Because if you're a materialist, your brain is restricted to the physical laws of the universe, and therefore your brain programmed you to say that. You have no free will to complain about free will. That's a problem in the atheistic perspective. It's a serious problem, which is why Barker says in his Compatibilist Regarding Free Will that we have the illusion of free will. I see your debate with Peter Payne here, 2005. You have the illusion of free will. Why would he raise the argument of free will if he has the illusion of free will? Is that consistent? What I tried to do was demonstrate that there are transcendentals. You don't look under a rock to find God. I've experienced him. You won't believe me if I told you what happened. I used to be an atheist agnostic. I wanted to be a marine biologist. Something happened. I changed. There's a reason. I'm no stupid person. I'm not an idiot. I check things out. Go check out my website. Use logic, but see if your presuppositions and your assumptions can be maintained in your particular worldview. Do the transcendentals that exist, the transcendental of the truths that are not dependent, that which is transcendental, is not dependent upon space and time for their validity. The laws of logic are not dependent upon when and where you are. They're always true, they're independent of the physical brain. How does an atheist worldview account for the transcendentals? If God is transcendental and his mind is transcendental and he enters into our physical realm, then we have the eminence of transcendental qualities in our physical realm that we can detect because we're made in the image of God, Genesis 1:26. In the issue of creation, it's called the cosmological argument. I used it against the atheist Eddie Tabash. He couldn't refute it. If you have an impersonal cause that's prior to the universe that's existing ontologically forever, the necessary sufficient conditions required automatic result of creation. And I already stated that would mean the universe was infinitely old, but it's not. So therefore, it's not possible that an impersonal cause brought the universe into existence. The only other logical explanation is a personal cause decided. Transcendent eminence in the physical realm via creation. In the moral argument, if anybody wants to come up to me, any atheist, and say, that's right, that's wrong, you can only say it's your opinion. Which, I have your opinion, no problem. I won't argue. Got your opinion? Good, your opinion. Don't put your opinion on me and say that something I say or do or believe is right or wrong. Don't be doing that. You don't have any right. If you want to say society says, well, Matt, you're right. Who cares? Argumentum ad populum. The majority says it's right, so therefore it's right. Come on, think. The problem of evil exists in the atheist worldview. First of all, define evil. And if you're an evolutionist materialist, is rape bad because someone doesn't like it? Why is it bad? Is murder wrong because someone doesn't like that? In Exodus 20, verse 13, murder is wrong. That's how come I know. What? Oh, 2 minutes. That's how come I know it's always wrong to torture babies to death for one's personal pleasure, because God has stated and revealed it is wrong by nature. But you guys, if you're atheists, you cannot say something is wrong ontologically by nature. It can't have an innate value. You can only have an assigned value to it via your presuppositions, your desires, your wants. And I'm going to tell you something. This is the preacher in me. Sorry, I got to say this. But what you're going to do is you're going to behave and answer in a manner consistent with what you want already. I would challenge you to think about what it is you want. Is what you want godly or is what you want self-centered? Do you want to please yourself? You want to have your own mind the way you like it, get what you feel? Or you want to be loving and sacrificial like God in the person of Jesus Christ on the cross who died for our sins, and if you trust in him, you'll be saved from the righteous judgment of a holy God. It's there, and I could tell you stuff. I don't have time. But I want you to think as atheists, is your worldview, is your no-God position capable of explaining the rationality, the logical absolutes, the transcendental qualities of that, the very nature of logical, of moral absolutes, and the very existence of the universe? From an atheistic perspective, can you do that? No. None of them. Now, we'll see if you can, but none. And maybe we'll have a little dialogue on this later on. But I love talking to atheists about this stuff. Come on in. Come on in. Gotcha. Right? I have atheists say, how am I talking to you, man? I know. A lot of people don't. Christians don't either. Could I make them think? Well, I hope I'm making you think some. Thanks. Obviously, someone was praying for me.
Thank you, Matt. Dan, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Okay, now it's rebuttal time. Matt, you raised the Bible tonight. You brought it up. You brought up the God of the Bible tonight. You said that the Bible is the reason you know it's wrong to kill. I assume that if you believe that, you human beings are just too stupid to figure that out on our own. We need some code to tell us. You said that you think that most humans would agree that it is wrong to torture innocent babies for pleasure, although your own Bible says that you should do that. Psalm 137:9, the Bible from which you quoted, said, "Blessed are they which take and dash the little ones against the stones." That word blessed means happy. It doesn't say maybe during wartime there might be some regrettable collateral damage, you know. But the Bible says very clearly that since the Babylonians were anti-God, you should be happy to take their babies and dash them against the stones. So according to your own moral code, you should enjoy torturing innocent babies for pleasure. We atheists and agnostics, I think most Christians, agree that the measure for morality is not some external transcendent code. The measure for morality is in the real world, and that is harm. Whatever causes unnecessary harm is what we would, by definition, say wrong. Whatever contributes toward lessening or minimizing harm in the world is what we would say, by definition, is good. There's no big cosmic evil with a capital E, as if it were a thing out there. There's no big capital G for good, like there's some cosmic good that we're trying. It's relative to our species and relative to our needs and the things that we evolved to prefer. For example, water. Me giving a glass of water to Matt would be considered a good thing because water is good for his existence. If I gave him a bottle of arsenic, relative to our species and relative to our planet, that would not be a good thing to do. But it's not a cosmic thing, it's relative. We atheists, agnostics, secular humans have a very good natural basis to justify, objectively justify our moral decisions. Not that we all think that moral principles are absolutes out there. It has to do with the real world and real harm. We do have an answer, Matt. Maybe one of your ears isn't quite working as well as the other, like you said to me before. But there is a good secular natural explanation for the existence of what we call moral values within the natural universe. I did not say that human beings have free will. If you were listening carefully, I said no matter what you think about free will, and that's a good debate, certainly God, if he exists, would have it, whatever that is. That was my argument. So you were hitting a straw man there a little bit. But I think one of the biggest problems, and I think some of you can spot some of the fallacies in Matt's reasoning tonight. You might call it a category error, or you might call it the error of reification. Just because you have a word for something doesn't mean that's a thing. Just because you have a word like forgiveness. Oh, so there must be a big capital F forgiveness out there somewhere that we need to look for, right? Just because you have a word like logic or morality doesn't mean that those are things. Matt's trying to play this word game to turn words into transcendent things. Logic is a transcendent thing, when actually logic is not. Logic is, as he quoted from my book correctly, and I like to be quoted, Logic is a part of a functioning of a brain. You probably know about the scientist Emily Noether. Have some of you heard about her? She was about 100 years ago. She mathematically and scientifically came up with her, was it the Noether conjecture? The Noether hypothesis. That actually the laws of nature are not really laws in the sense that nature is trying to obey, like a speed limit. You know, as light is going through the universe, is it looking at the speed limit? Oh, I can't go faster than that. They're not what you would call prescriptive laws. Prescriptive laws are what we would say human laws are. They are descriptive laws. They describe, and in fact, the Noether hypothesis basically showed that the laws of nature are really not the laws of nature. They are the laws of physicists. They are the laws that physicists must follow to understand nature. They are not really laws that nature is doing. Logic is the same way. Logic is not something out there. Bertrand Russell kind of said it like this when he was debating Father Copplestone in 1948. He says, the category mistake that a lot of you theists are making is like, just because every human being in our species has a mother, doesn't mean, therefore, that this human race has a mother. You're taking a finding from one logical sphere and jumping up to try to make it apply to another logical sphere. If I were to say that all the musicians in an orchestra are playing in harmony with each other, does that mean, therefore, that every orchestra is playing in harmony with every other orchestra? You can see the category mistake. We all know that in Philosophy 101, that you can't do that. You can't jump from one level up to another and then make it apply. That's exactly what Matt has done with the cause. Our concept of cause and effect is something that we find within our natural universe by observation, time is part of that. One of the reasons we know what causes what and what effect follows is because of time. If there's no time, you can't have cause and effect. So what Matt's trying to do, he's trying to take the findings within the universe of what we know about cause and effect and then apply it to the whole universe as if that would be a meaningful statement to make about the cause of the universe, right? Well, now there's more and more and more scientists are coming around to the very high probability of the existence of a multiverse of some form. It's still a hypothesis, but we can indeed say that the universe, this universe we live in, probably is surrounded by something transcendent. Transcendent does not mean supernatural. A transcendent realm can be a natural realm. There can be a natural cause. When a snowflake forms, look at the beautiful pattern of the snowflake. Does someone think that somebody came along with their fingers and moved all those little molecules to create this work of art? Or can we explain them without reference to some personal transcendent? Can we explain them with reference to the natural universe? Now scientists, and Vic Stenger in his new book, God and the Multiverse, points out that the multiverse arises naturally from the mathematics of chaotic inflation in the early part of the universe, which is not a cause in the same sense that we would talk about cause and effect in our natural universe. So he's creating a category mistake and a reification mistake, but also a logical mistake, talking about how if there were an infinite series of preceding effects before this one, we never could have arrived at now, but we have arrived at now. Therefore, there could not have been, there had to be a first cause, right? Because otherwise we couldn't have traversed an infinity. Well, that logic also applies to God. If there is a God, God has a functioning mind, and that mind has what you would call antecedent causes to it. For example, before God created the universe, he had to decide to create the universe, right? The deciding didn't happen after the creating. Did God wake up one day and say, look, I created a universe. Well, now I'm going to decide to do that. Obviously, in the mind of a God, whether he's in time or out of time, whatever the heck that could possibly mean, let's just assume that means something. This God has to have, be in his own mind, a series of preceding antecedent decisions and wants and thoughts. And according to your own logic, if an actual infinity cannot exist in reality, because we never would have traversed it, then God himself must have had a first thought. And that shows how your argument is turning around and inviting itself in the posterior. So either stick to your premise and apply it to your God itself or himself or herself or whatever it is, or get rid of the premise. The premise is a bad premise. You cannot ask I know this sounds funny, but you cannot ask, like Matt asked, is logic logical? That is an incoherent question. It sounds good, doesn't it? It's like kind of like what Daniel Dennett would say is a deepity. Deepities are phrases that you can speak, like love is a four-letter word. Wow, yeah. And we think it really means something. So, but when you scratch beneath it, what is actually happening? What is north of the North Pole? You know, I mean, things like that, that you can put into a sentence, but you cannot ask, is logic logical? It's like asking, is harmony harmonious? Or how do you digest digestion? See, it's jumping up the logical sphere. Logic is not something that we find has to be logical. Logic has to be useful. There are not these things out there called the law of excluded middle that exist independent of minds. It, like Emily Noether said with her conjecture, these laws of logic are really laws in the descriptive sense of how a properly functioning mind uses when it is observing the universe. So Matt is trying to pull a rabbit out of a hat. He's trying to create these immaterial transcendent realities out there and saying, see, look, these things exist, therefore that's consistent with the existence of my God. That's just bad reasoning and bad logic. So we know the logic is bad because we test it with observation. You don't test logic with logic, you test logic by observation. And look at your premises, you see if your premise is good. You can have a perfectly logical conclusion that is wrong. Logic doesn't always give you truth. Logic can give you untruth if your premise is bad. So these are just descriptive, what we call laws of how human mind and how human reasoning works. So there's more to say about your opening statement, but basically I think what I have said is enough of a rebuttal to show there's a lot of fallacies in your thinking, just like there was in the mind of John Calvin.